Our custom is to pause a few moments for silent prayer before we begin our Bible classes. This provides you the opportunity to utilize the privacy of your priesthood and rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are grateful to You for providing us the opportunity and the privilege of continuing our spiritual advance by the study of Your Scriptures. Our prayers the Holy Spirit would empower us to concentrate and to metabolize those things we're about to note, that we might enlarge our spiritual inventory, that our decision-making would become more precise as it relates to Your plan, and that we might be able as a result to glorify Jesus Christ while magnifying the Word. And we lift our prayer in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. Today we're going to amplify some concepts which emerge from the first half of verse 10 in Hebrews chapter 12. In fact, in order to put things into context, I might thumb through my notes here and find where we have a corrected translation of as far as we've gone, beginning in verse 5. And so you yourselves have forgotten the doctrinal instruction which teaches you as sons. My son, stop making light of the Lord's chastisement, nor become discouraged when you're reproved by Him. For you see whom the Lord loves, He disciplines by means of chastisement, and punishes to the maximum every son whom He welcomes home. Because of corrective discipline, endure. For God deals with you as sons. For what individual believer is a son whom the father does not discipline? But if you are without this corrective discipline, of which all believers have become participators, and it should happen to be that you are without such corrective discipline, then you are bastards and not sons. Another point. We used to have our human parents for corrective chastisement, and we looked upon them with respect. To a greater degree, you will become subordinate to the Father of our human spirits and continue living. For parents, on the one hand, disciplined us for a short time according to what seemed best to them. We noted Thursday that parents do the best they can. This takes in an entire vista of approaches, for there are non-doctrinal parents, there are doctrinal parents, there are heathen parents, confused parents, we might call it self-righteous parents, lascivious parents. There's every conceivable category out there, and they're raising children. The principle found here is, no matter what category you consider, generally speaking, parents seek to do the best they can. They establish policy, however, which is based on their own personal standards. Their desire is to develop a set of norms and standards in the conscience of their child. Now, when these norms and standards are based on principles developed from Bible doctrine, then the child has an inventory of what might be called Christian values. And that, of course, would be unique to parents who are advancing in the plan of God and are conveying these thoughts and ideas to their children, thus developing a conscience with these principles. Yet in a day in which politicians have taken up the cloth and have decided to make an issue of values, both family and national, we saw it was a good idea to take a brief moment to look at a list of Christian values. We noted on Thursday Galatians 5, 22 and 23, James 1, verses 2 and 3, 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 14 through 22, and then 2 Antidiplocles, the first by Paul in Romans 5, verses 3 through 5, and the second by Peter in 2 Peter 1, verses 4 through 8. Now, the values that are noted in those passages are absolutes. They are unique to the Christian experience. They can be maintained only by the power of the Holy Spirit. They are what Russell Kirk calls the permanent things. They reflect the result of countless cultures' real-life experiences over the period of millennia. If you turn people loose long enough, they're going to ultimately figure out what the best method is of getting along with each other. And therefore, they develop concepts of right and wrong. Cultures may vary, but they all establish eventually concepts of right and wrong to which the majority seek to subscribe. And those who violate these standards, therefore, are said to be recalcitrant, lawbreakers, criminals, or antisocial. Attempts to discredit established truths, therefore, can only result in folly. Yet this is exactly what has been attempted in American schools for virtually all of the 20th century. Now, what we're going to do today is examine the concept of deconstructing parental authority. Parents do the best they can, and they have a right to develop the consciences and the stream of conscience of their children. They have a right to determine what goes in there. They have a right to decide what will establish right and wrong for their children. Parents have this right. It is delegated to them by God at the moment that He selects the child at physical birth. And therefore, for outside agencies, outside organizations to come in and systematically and knowingly deconstruct what parents teach their children is a very serious brand of evil. And so we're going to note that today in our study. We resume, therefore, at point 16 for those of you who count. And there we note that since our nation's founding, its Anglo-Saxon, Judeo-Christian, and Western European heritage has struggled to maintain a culture based on absolute principles of right and wrong by incorporating them into our codes of civil and criminal law. Involved, but it gets said all I needed to get said. Since our nation's founding, its Anglo-Saxon, Judeo-Christian, and Western European heritage has struggled to maintain a culture based on absolute principles of right and wrong by incorporating them into our codes of civil and criminal law. Our culture has sought to maintain these standards of right and wrong. And I can tell you that Anglo-Saxon, Judeo-Christian, Western European heritage is based on Protestant theology. And without it, no nation can survive. And without it, we had what was called the Dark Ages. Point 17. About 80 years ago, outside forces began to influence this zeitgeist. A zeitgeist established by our founders, all steeped in Protestant theology. All but three of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were believers, regardless of what the historical reconstructionists try to tell you. Over the last three decades, the national conscience has suffered almost a complete inversion. And this inversion and this influence on the zeitgeist has been primarily centered on deconstructing parental authority. Now, I'll tell you what, I would not want to have a child today of munchkin age. If I thought I had to go through the public school system again, I think I'd just shoot myself. Removed from reality doesn't cover it. An assault on the souls of children is the best way to describe it. 18. True education is based on a system of didactics where an informed instructor conveys facts inherent to a given subject to uninformed students who learn the information and thus become knowledgeable themselves. That is true education. True education is based on a system of didactics where an informed instructor conveys facts inherent to a given subject to uninformed students who learn the information and thus become knowledgeable themselves. Conveyance of facts, data, and information to a child's intellect, not his emotions. There can be no knowledge in emotion. Knowledge is found in intellect. And I am telling you that today we have converted from solving problems through principle to solving problems through emotion. Does it feel right to do that? Then we do it. We have leaders who feel right about going into Bosnia. So that, therefore, we go. Principle says, don't go. Emotion, to those who can't think, says go. We need to bring peace. We need to help these people. We need to prevent bloodshed. We need to stop this war. And we at least need to try to do the best we can. Now, that is emotion, and it is not principle, and it is emotion over intellect. 19. A true classical education was possible in this country up until about 1930. Russell Kirk writes of his youth in his biography entitled The Sword of Imagination. In chapter 2, he has a section called When Public Schools Taught Disciplines. Before we embark upon that reading of a few paragraphs, I need to provide for you two definitions necessary to understand Dr. Kirk's quote and the remainder of our study this morning. Instrumentalism. I'll put the second one up. And progressivism. Instrumentalism will be the first that we define. One of the things you will note is that when you try to discern what's going on in the academy, you have to get involved in their vernacular. And their vernacular will put you to sleep. But if you do not understand what they're doing, if you can't put a term on what they're doing, then you will be confused about what they're doing. So you have to understand these sort of silly-sounding words in order to know what's going on. So here's instrumentalism as defined first of all by Webster's and then by the Encyclopedia Britannica. Instrumentalism, a doctrine that ideas are instruments of action and that their usefulness determines their truth. Ideas are instruments of action, and their usefulness determines their truth. Now that was Webster's, a little broader definition from the Encyclopedia Britannica. A philosophy advanced by John Dewey. Now at least we know what ballpark we're in. A philosophy advanced by John Dewey that holds that what is most important in an idea is its value as an instrument of action, and that the truth of an idea lies in its usefulness. What does all of that mean? The end justifies the means. It doesn't matter what means you use, legal, illegal, good, bad, evil, perverse, or nice and tidy. Does it solve the problem? problem solving to the instrumentalists says get the problem solved. If you have to compromise principle, then compromise principle. Compromise integrity. It doesn't matter. The issue is to solve the problem. So truth becomes what solves the problem. And this is what your children are being taught. Continuing with the encyclopedia, ideas are conceived as instruments of transforming the usefulness arising from facing a problem into the satisfaction of solving it. Ideas are conceived as instruments for transforming the uneasiness arising from facing a problem. Uneasiness, that's emotion. Transform that uneasiness into the satisfaction, another emotion, of solving it. Now, there is a system of problem-solving devices that has been taken up by free enterprise in this country, and here it is. Win-win, lose-lose. It's right out of the pits of hell. The idea on a win-win, you have party A and party B, and they are in disagreement. And so the idea is to come up with a solution to this disagreement where A wins and B wins. And you say, well, that sounds nice. Why wouldn't that be a good idea? Because if they have meaningful disagreements, the only way that both can win is for each to compromise. And when you're dealing with absolute principles, you cannot compromise. There is no compromise. We can't get along. Ain't gonna get along. No compromise. Somebody wins, somebody else loses. Now let's take Bosnia, for example. Let's see how win-win, lose-lose works there. Let's take the Clinton administration and let's take traditional thinking public. What would a win be for the traditional thinking public? A win would be nobody gets a bad headache. That serves as a win for the Clinton administration because they are seen as those who kept the peace. That's a win if nobody gets a bad headache. And what it further does, it advances the notion of a global police force using the U.S. military as the strong arm. Therefore, traditional thinking people actually lose. Now that's a win-win situation. And if you win, Clinton wins twice. If you win over here, you also lose because you lose your freedom. Now let's take a look at the lose-lose category. Let's say that we have body bags by the thousands. That's a loss for traditional thinking people. Over here, it is a loss for Clinton. And over here, he is a complete loser. But over here, we not only have we lost a lot of people, we've also lost in the endeavor of trying to maintain this peace and what have you. So Clinton's over here going to lose if there's a lot of body bags. But his whole deal is he wants to take the risk. And that is a term that you'll see bandied about among educationalists, and we'll note it today. Risk-taking says you have a situation, it is a problem, it needs to be solved, take a risk. And that's what he's doing. For if he can come out of this thing looking good, then he will look good for the 96 election. If he doesn't, it doesn't matter because he's going to lose anyhow. If we come out looking good over here, we win, but we also lose. If we lose, a lot of people get killed, then that is obviously a loss on every category. So this man has got a situation to where all he can do is win. He can't lose because he's already lost. So he's sacrificing a lot of people's lives, at least placing them on the line, in hopes of winning. He's taking a risk. Progressivism. Webster's, an educational theory marked by emphasis on the individual child, informality of classroom procedure, and encouragement of self-expression. So we have three categories here for progressive education: emphasis on the individual child, informality of classroom procedure, and encouragement of self-expression. One, believing in moderate political change and especially social improvement by governmental action. Now from the encyclopedia. Movement that took form in both Europe and the United States during the late 19th century as a reaction to the alleged narrowness and formalism of traditional education. I did a wedding last night out at Daniel Boone's home, and they have a one-room schoolhouse there, and we went in. Fireplace blazing. We all decided that the first fight of the day was who sat near the fireplace on nights like last night. And they had these very rudimentary desks and a blackboard. And people were able to advance to very high levels of education in that environment. In fact, some of them wrote the Declaration of Independence. Some of them wrote the Constitution of the United States and are very eloquent in their speeches. They learned it all in a one-room schoolhouse with a blackboard. That's called narrowness and formalism. One of its main objectives, that's progressive education, according to its proponents, was to educate the whole child. Now get this, they have taken it upon themselves to educate the whole child. That is, to attend to his physical as well as emotional needs, along with what is the intellectual growth associated with the academy. Intellectual is one phase. Emotional and physical are the two they added. The theory was that a child learns best by actually performing tasks associated with learning. Creative and manual arts gained importance in the curriculum, and children were encouraged toward experimentation and independent thinking. The classroom, in the view of the progressivist's greatest theorist, U.S. philosopher John Dewey, was to be a, quote, democracy in microcosm, end quote. The sources of the progressive education movement lay partly in European pedagogical reforms from the 17th through the 19th centuries, ultimately stemming mostly from the French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Émile, a treatise on education in novel form that has been called, quote, the Charter of Childhood. Now, with some brief understanding of progressivism and instrumentalism, let's look at a classical education enjoyed by Russell Kirk. He says, until 1927 or 1928, John Dewey's instrumentalism and progressivism and pedagogy did not reach so far as the public schools of Plymouth, Michigan. What was taught at Plymouth schools in the 20s? Why, the essentials, by teachers who knew their disciplines. It was printed in Russell's sixth grade reader, quote, the foundation of the book must be the acknowledged masterpieces of American and British authors, end quote. The literary culture imparted by the common school would begin to weaken a few years later. The false humanism of John Dewey, with Dewey's contempt of the literature of the past, would riddle the curriculum within the schools. In 1929, and for some years thereafter, nobody would have thought of suggesting that Starkweather School offered an elitist program of literary studies. Kirk's schoolmates came from families of limited and uncertain means. In other words, because they studied the writings of the great authors of America and Great Britain, was never conceived of as an elitist education. You know, the elite are classified by progressive and instrumentalist as those who have money. Nobody has money unless they can think. And if they have it without being able to think, they inherited it. You have to know what you're doing. And you learn what you're doing by going to school and learning the rudiments, by rote if necessary, of those subjects found in a classical education. Therefore, it's not elitist to learn and to advance in your thought and thus advance in your own lifestyle. When Russell entered junior high school in the middle of the town, he was introduced to a curriculum with only one weak link, the course in civics, a Deweyite innovation. The rest, 6 years of literature, 3 years of history, including ancient, modern, and American, a year of physics and one of chemistry, also a year of algebra and one of geometry, 2 years of Latin, a year of speech. As concessions to utilitarianism, a term of woodshop and a term of first aid, 4 years of physical training, a term of typewriting, a term of business law well taught by the superintendent of schools. Those courses occupied 6 years of Russell's life. He was very active also on the high school debate squad and on the school newspaper. In this curriculum, which nobody challenged, there occurred no teaching of religion, except as religious beliefs were examined incidentally in the study of history or humane letters when it was a part of the subject it was discussed and pointed out. He goes on to say, nor were there ever prayers in schools. Yet, Christian morals were taken for granted. Nearly all the teachers belonged to one denomination or another, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, and Baptist chiefly. Their assumptions about ultimate questions were derived from Christian doctrine, but dogmatic instruction was left entirely to the several Sunday schools of the churches. By the time he entered junior high school, he could write well and on serious subjects. How he acquired this skill, he did not then know. But it was probably because of his critical study from an early age of how Nathaniel Hawthorne, The Scarlet Letter, The House of Seven Gables, James Fenimore Cooper, The Spy, The Last of the Mohicans, Sir Walter Scott, Rob Roy, Ivanhoe, Mark Twain, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and of Huckleberry Finn, Charles Dickens, Oliver Twist, David Copperfield, how these men and other great novelists went about their business, how they formed their sentences, how they contrived to give flesh to people. Point 20. All this has changed, and dramatically so, since 1929. And has reached the point of total inversion by the mid-1990s. This inversion is illustrated in a book by Thomas Sowell entitled Inside American Education. I'm going to quote to you extensively now from Chapter 3 of the book, which is entitled Classroom Brainwashing. And what I hope to point out here, those of you who will stay awake, others will have to get tapes later, is how there is a systematic deconstruction of parental authority. Parents do the best they can, and they're delegated the authority to do it by the God of this universe. And for someone to come in and systematically and knowingly deconstruct the values taught children by parents is a big pit of evil. And this demonstrates it by Dr. Sowell. A variety of courses and programs under an even wider variety of names have been set up in schools across the country to change the values, behavior, and beliefs of American youngsters from what they've been taught by their families, their churches, or the social groups in which they've grown up. These ambitious attempts to reshape the attitudes and consciousness of a generation are as pervasive as they are little known, partly because they kept a low profile, but more often because they are called by other high-sounding names. He lists a few high-sounding names of intrusive courses that are designed to deconstruct parental authority. See if you recognize any. Values clarification. Decision-making. There are many other imaginative titles, he says. The particular door through which such programs enter the school curriculum, whether it's sex ed, decision making, quest, or what have you, the door it gets in is not as important as what they do after they have gained entrance. If these programs are often not what they claim to be, then what are they? They are attempts to reshape values, attitudes, and beliefs to fit a very different vision of the world from what children have received from their parents and the social environment in which they are raised. Instead of educating the intellect, these special curriculum programs condition the emotions. We are raising children to make decisions based on emotions and not on intellect. And he says it right here, and he's right. Comes out in our study. I'd pass along here the definition of brainwashing from Edward Hunter's book entitled Brainwashing, A Political Strategy for Control Using Two Processes. Number one, you condition the individual so you can control them. So there's a conditioning process, and that's playing with a child's emotions. And then once you get them in your hand emotionally, then you indoctrinate them for conversion. And that's political correctness. This is sometimes called effective education, as distinguished from intellectual education. And he says it can also be called brainwashing. He says a variety of programs used in classrooms across the country not only share the general goals of brainwashing, that is, changing fundamental attitudes, values, and belief by psychological conditioning methods, but also use classic brainwashing techniques. Now, he's going to demonstrate here that in a watered-down version, children are being brainwashed by the public education system. Use the same techniques, just not the brutality. There's a five-step process. Number one is emotional stress, shock, or desensitization. It's important to understand the definition of desensitization so you can appreciate this. So here's the definition from Webster's. To make emotionally insensitive or callous. To take a person and make them emotionally insensitive or even callous. Specifically, to extinguish an emotional response such as fear, anxiety, or guilt. To extinguish an emotional response to stimuli that formerly induced it. In other words, remove from the child normal restraint. Emotional stress, shock, or desensitization is used to break down both intellectual and emotional resistance. Second step is isolation, whether physical or emotional, from familiar sources of emotional support in resistance. Example, when a child stands up for the values he's been taught at home in the classroom and the teacher disagrees, then she will isolate him by making an exposition of him to the other classmates. Do you agree with this? And the majority will say no, and then he is embarrassed because he holds the minority view. That's isolation. Then the third is cross-examining pre-existing values. This is often done by manipulating peer pressure to bring other students forward who disagree with the child who expresses a belief in certain values, and then having a cross-examination process go on between them where the child has to defend his values against those of a classmate which are different. The fourth step, stripping the individual of normal defenses, such as personal reserve, dignity, a sense of privacy, or the ability to declare to participate. In other words, the child is forced to stand up and defend his values, and therefore his normal defenses are stripped down as a result. The final phase is rewarding acceptance of the new attitudes, values, and beliefs. This can be simply a release from the pressures inflicted by those upon those who resist. Now, he examines these individually. First, we have stress and desensitization. There are all too many examples illustrating the use of these methods in psychological conditioning programs in the public schools. He gives an example. Viewers on the ABC Television Network program 2020, September 21, 1990, may have been surprised or even upset when they saw school children being taken to a morgue and being encouraged to touch the corpses as part of death education. Some viewers may have thought this exercise pointless as well as tasteless. But this exercise was by no means pointless as a part of a psychological conditioning program. On the contrary, it was an example of the first step in brainwashing, stress, and desensitization. Some children undoubtedly found the experience stressful, some perhaps shocking, and more generally, it served to desensitize normal inhibitions. An historical study of brainwashing techniques in various countries and in various periods of history found emotional disruption to be essential to the process. Emotional disruption is essential to the process. It's not death education that's the issue. It is the desensitization that goes on, breaking down normal restraints. The trip to the morgue was not a pointless exercise from this perspective. Public schools do not have the degree of control maintained by totalitarian governments, but the targets of their brainwashing are younger and more vulnerable to milder versions of the same brainwashing techniques used by Stalin and Mao Zedong. Desensitizing experiences have been common in death education programs as well as in many other kinds of psychological conditioning programs. Then he moves and examines numbers 2 and 3 together, isolation and cross-examination. He says the success of brainwashing depends not only on the stress brought to bear on the targeted individuals, but also on the extent to which their resistance can be undermined. So you have to undermine whatever resistance they have to the new ideas. Isolation, meaning disconnecting them from the psychological support of those who share their values, is one way of undermining their resistance. Now, who are those who share their values? Primarily their parents. So you have to disassociate them from their parents and isolate them from their parents. The emotional vulnerability of school children makes psychological isolation easier to achieve. A witness testifying at U.S. Department of Education hearings reported observing the treatment of a first grade child who failed to have his values reshaped to the teacher's liking. Here's the quote. The teacher then asked how many of the students agreed with him. By the tone of her voice, the students knew no one should raise a hand, so no one did. The little boy was so humiliated by the peer pressure and class manipulation by the teacher that he began to cry. That's the first grade experience. A similar manipulation of peers against a recalcitrant was discovered by another parent in another school. Here's the quote. Mr. Davis, the teacher, would bring up a controversial moral issue, such as premarital sex or homosexuality, and call on members of the class to defend their positions on the issue. He would call upon those with opposite moral beliefs from John, the student in the example, thus exerting peer pressure on John to change his moral views. John was consistently called on up to 23 times per class session to defend his values before his friends who held opposing views. When John mentioned to Mr. Davis that he was calling on him more than anyone else, Mr. Davis just said, "Oh," and continued calling on him. Isolation from peers is only part of the process. And one way or another, students must also be emotionally isolated from the support of their parents. Some psychological conditioning programs have the children sit in a circle called a magic circle, where everything that is said there is confidential. Some programs explicitly tell the children that they're not to tell their parents what is said or done in the magic circle. Moreover, the undermining and discrediting of parents is a recurring theme in most of these type programs. While it is parents who are undermined directly, it is the child who is thus isolated to face this brainwashing alone. Fourth category, stripping away defenses. In Maoist China, where the term brainwashing originated, an important part of the process was the, quote, writing of autobiographies and diaries, which were then discussed by the group to which the individual belonged. This was not a matter of acquiring facts, but of discovering psychological vulnerabilities, getting you to divulge the weakness of your sin nature so then it can be exploited by the intellectual elite of the Communist Party. And they would put a big guilt trip on you and make you feel embarrassed about even being alive. So they wanted to discover psychological vulnerabilities and put the individual on the defensive. As one individual who had been through this process described it, quote, a straight narrative of your past life was not enough. For every action you described, you had to give its motive in detail. Your awakened criticism had to be apparent in every sentence. You had to say why you smoked, why you drank, why you had social connections with certain people. Why? Many irrelevant details, once they became public property in the discussion group, could then be used by the director of the group to probe for, quote, sore spots at which the individual was emotionally vulnerable. And that was very relevant to the brainwashing process. George Orwell described a similar technique in his novel 1984. This same technique is widely used by psychological conditioning programs in American public schools. In fourth grade and sixth grade classes in Tucson, diaries were signed with the specific instruction that the student, quote, could write about her personal problems and family relationships even if they were bad, because the teacher is her friend and would not tell. Similar assurances of confidentiality from parents were made in New Hampshire, though the sharing of these diaries in the group meant that family confidences were betrayed to strangers. In the Orwellian newspeak, widely found among advocates of psychological conditioning programs, assignments creating pressure or compulsion to reveal personal and family matters are referred to as an opportunity. When you put pressure on a child to reveal personal or family matters, it is described as an opportunity. For example, quote, an opportunity to generate meaningful information about themselves which can be shared with others, end quote. And Dr. Sowell says, obviously people always have an opportunity to reveal anything they choose to anyone they choose at any time they choose. Psychological conditioning programs do not provide opportunity, but pressure or compulsion. A leading book on the so-called values clarification approach to attitude changing likewise refers to giving the student, quote, the opportunity to publicly affirm and explain his stand on various values issues. During this opportunity, the teacher may ask the student any question about any aspect of his life and values. All this is called helping students get acquainted with each other on a more personal basis. When the class is further broken down into small groups, this provides students with an opportunity to share on a more intimate basis than when addressing the whole class. Something called privacy circles, strategy number 21, it's called in the leadership guide, give students the opportunity to find out whom they are willing to tell what. While students are not directly forced to talk in this particular approach, they are encouraged to talk and to talk at length. Among the questions which school children were given an opportunity to answer were the following. What disturbs you most about your parents? Would you bring up your children differently from the way you're being brought up? What would you change? As a child, These are students now in high school at best. As a child, did you ever run away from home? Did you ever want to? Who is the boss in your family? Do you believe in God? How do you feel about homosexuality? Do you have any brothers and sisters? How do you get along? What is the saddest thing you can remember? Is there something you once did that you're ashamed of? In addition to questions such as these, students have an opportunity to tell such things as the following. Describe a time of your greatest despair. Reveal who in your family brings you the greatest sadness and why. Then share who brings you the greatest joy. Tell some ways in which you will be a better parent than your own parents are now. Tell something about a frightening sexual experience. Critics have often been so outraged by such questions that they have not sought to discover why these kinds of questions are being asked in the first place from the standpoint of those who are asking. Such questions strip away all defenses and leave the student vulnerable to the brainwashing process. On a practical level, not only the child but the parents are left vulnerable as well. Family secrets revealed by children in school can be used to claim that objections to these programs are attributable to the parents' own psychological problem. You're rendered insane if you disagree, because they've got a whole dossier on the problems you people have around the household. Don't ever complain with a child about anything. Don't ever raise your voice. Don't ever discipline them. Don't do anything but say what nice, sweet, kind people you are, you always have been and always will be, and therefore there won't be anything in the dossier. But then you'll have a demon for a child too. Well, we move on to a section called brainwashing agendas. Attitude-changing programs involve so many thousands of schools, so many teachers, administrators, and facilitators, and so many commercial, ideological, and other interests that it is impossible to ascribe a single purpose to all involved. What's the single purpose behind all of this? He says there's too many people involved in it. There's no way to isolate it. But he then goes on to say, yet a broad consensus in approach and agenda can be discerned. A broad consensus in approach and agenda, that can be discerned. He says, the most general principle of these various programs is that decisions are not to be made by relying on traditional values passed on by parents or the surrounding society. That's the general trend in all of these, regardless of the subject matter, and so that's the hidden agenda. Sex education, drug education, advanced and talented, all of these things, that's the rhetorical veil. The hidden agenda is as follows. These various programs' most general approach is that decisions are not to be made by relying on traditional values passed on by parents or the surrounding society. Instead, those values are themselves to be questioned and then compared with the values and behavior of other individuals or other societies. Multiculturalism. This is to be done in a neutral or non-judgmental manner. No one set of values is superior to any other set. So this is to be done in a neutral or non-judgmental manner, which does not seek to determine a right or wrong way, but rather to find out what feels best to the particular individuals. What feels best to the child. That's what's right for you. This general approach has been called, quote, values clarification. It focuses on the feelings of the individual rather than on the requirements of a functioning society or the requirements of intellectual analysis.
No intellectual analysis is needed when you can make decisions based on how you feel. Critics have called this approach cultural relativism. For a recurring theme in attitude-changing programs is that what our society believes is just one of many beliefs with equal validity. Individuals have the option to choose for themselves what to believe and what to value. Central to this questioning of authority is a questioning of the role of central authority in the child's life, namely the parents. Alternative ways of constructing individual values independently of parental values are recurring themes of curriculum materials on subjects from sex to death. That's the rhetorical veil. The hidden agenda is deconstruction of parental authority. Parents as pariahs is the next section we will note. And following that, peers as guides. And then next, risk as adventure. The plot thickens. And we will begin to advance on that at about 20 till the hour.